From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and I am Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you're going to hear a couple of interviews. The first one actually is going to be an interview from the archives with the author Robert Vivian. And then in the second hour of the show, we will have a live interview with an author who is in Bozeman, Montana, Christy Stillwell. And her new book is The Wolf Tone. But first off, we're going to do an interview from the archives with Robert Vivian. He was born in Denver, Colorado in 1967 and raised in Omaha, Nebraska. He teaches at Alma College and in the Low Residency MFA program at the Vermont College of Fine Arts. Dozens of his plays have been produced in New York City and elsewhere, and his poems, essays, and stories have appeared in many literary journals, including Georgia Review, Harper's, Ecotone, Creative Nonfiction, and others. He has published four novels, The Tall Grass Trilogy, the first of which, The Mover of Bones, is the book we discussed in the interview you're going to hear today. And then there were two others, Lamb Bright Saviors and Another Burning Kingdom. And then his other novel is Water and Abandon. And then he has two books of meditative essays, Cold Snap as Yearning and The Least Cricket of Evening. And his first book of dervish essays or prose poems, Mystery, My Country, was published in 2016 by Anchor and Plume. He has visited and taught in Turkey several times and has been heavily influenced by the works of Rumi. In the summer, he tries to fly fish in northern Michigan every day, and when he can't, he dreams about it anyway. When I spoke to Robert Vivian, I asked him about the inspiration for his book Mover of Bones, which was the first in the trilogy I just mentioned. I hope you enjoy our conversation. That, again, was a conversation with the author Robert Vivian. You can learn more about his work at robertvivian.org. So we have a little bit of time before my conversation with Christy Stillwell. Her book, The Wolf Tone, involves, among other things, a cellist. So while we wait for the 4 o'clock hour, I'm going to just play some music, and I'll start out with some relevant music. Actually, I believe this particular piece is even in the book. So we'll start out with the Bach Cello Suite number 1 in G major from Bach. Cello Suite number 1 in G major, BWV 1007 Prelude. We'll start with that. From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, you're listening to WBTV LP, Burlington, 99.3 FM, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and this is the second half of the show. And today, on the rest of the show, you're going to hear a live conversation with the author Christy Stillwell, whose debut novel, The Wolf Tone, came out in January from Elixir Press. I'm going to share a little information now about Christy, and then she and I will have our conversation. So Christy Stillwell earned a BA in English at the University of Georgia before moving west, first to Wyoming and then Montana. She taught college freshmen, tutored adults in writing skills, clerked in bookstores and edited manuscripts, college essays, textbooks, and artist statements. She holds an MA in Literature from the University of Wyoming and an MFA from the Warren Wilson College Program for Writers. Finishing Line Press published her chapbook of poetry, Amnesia, in 2008. Poems, short fiction, and essays have appeared in journals such as Pearl, River City, Sonora Review, Sou'wester, the Massachusetts Review, LiteraryMama.com, and the Tishman Review. Christy Stillwell has been honored with a residency at our own Vermont Studio Center here in Johnson and a Wyoming Arts Council Literary Fellowship, and her work has been nominated for a Pushcart Prize and was a finalist in the Glimmer Train Short Story Contest. Her debut novel, The Wolf Tone, won the Elixir Press Fiction Prize in 2017 and has, as I said, just come out. She lives with her family in Bozeman, Montana, and I have her on the line. Are you there, Christy?
I am.
Okay, great. Ooh, I just had you a little too loud. Sorry, listeners. I had her voice way up there. It's great to have you on the show, and I really enjoyed the wolf tone. I'm looking forward to talking about it with you today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's great. I wonder if we can start. Why don't you start out by telling us what the wolf tone means? The actual title of the book has an interesting meaning that I'd never heard about.
Okay, it's a pretty common phenomenon that occurs in all string instruments, especially the large ones like your bass and cello. And technically what it is a sound that occurs, or a vibration, a frequency, when the vibration of the string is in competition with the vibration of the body of the instrument. And so these two vibrations kind of cancel each other out and make this howling sound that all string players of large instruments have to figure out how to deal with. It's quite common.
Okay. Are you a musician?
I'm not.
Okay. So, all right. Well, I have a question later about research, but let's start with just talking about how this book started for you. What was the sort of initiating moment for you in starting the wolf tone?
Well, it kind of came from over many years and a couple of different angles. And the music angle was probably first, because that was years ago when my son was in, he was probably four, and he was in swimming lessons with a little boy, and there were only two of them in the lessons. And so this other mom I had seen on the pool deck reading, and yeah. I'm always kind of nosy when someone's reading. I always want to know what it is. So I, you know, kind of nonchalantly walked by and tried to take a look, and I saw that it was not a book, it was music. And that just really struck me as to what kind of person reads music on a pool deck, whether a kid has a swimming lesson, and why. And then that got me kind of thinking about, I love classical music. I'm not an aficionado, but I do love it. And then I started to really think about players, classical music players, and what kind of life they have, and why they might read music on a pool deck. And
right.
Sure enough, it turned out several years later that woman was the principal cellist for the Bozeman Symphony, and I met her and took her out for coffee, and that began my research for that sort of vector of the novel. I knew I wanted to write about a musician.
Okay, that's great. One of the things I really loved in The Wolf Tone is your characters and your character descriptions. And I wonder if you mind terribly if I read a description of Sully when you introduce him early in the book, and then we can talk a little bit about describing characters and introducing characters.
Excellent.
Okay, great. So this is from early on. The character's name is Sully. He didn't try to be sexy, and if he did, he'd fail. He was no hard body, with his thick middle and broad shoulders. His signature outfit was Russell athletic shorts and old Nikes. Up top, he wore a t-shirt or a sweatshirt, usually both. Her high school friends would call him a loser, an old man without prospects. And then I'm going to skip forward a little bit. Sully might be old and out of shape, but he was a dad. He knew the layout of the children's museum and the dates and times of free pizza night. He knew the rec swim hours at the public pool and how many tickets won you a decent prize at Geyser Park. He was also an ex-soldier, missing half his left hand. His moody, pale eyes could be unreadable. He was prone to funks and sometimes an explosive temper. He was sexy. So I loved that you start out, that's from the point of view of a character named Eva, or Ava. I'm not sure how you imagine her name to be pronounced.
I always pronounce it Eva.
Eva, okay. So it starts out, He didn't try to be sexy, and he would fail if he did. But then at the very end, it's like, he was sexy. And that was such a great kind of like way to close out that introductory description of him. So I wonder, how do you approach describing characters when you're first writing about them? And how do you figure out what characteristics they have in the first place?
Well, it's not quick for me.
Yeah.
It might be for some writers. It isn't for me. It took me a long time to get to know Sully. Although I must say, when I first started, you know, I talked about the cello player that I met that I saw on the pool deck, but another whole vector of the story. And in fact, where I first started physically writing words about this story, not just thinking about it, was with Sully. And so he was really the first character that I met, and I probably spent the most time with him until I finally figured out Margot, and then she took a long time too. But I knew Sully was a pot grower, and I knew he was involved with the medical marijuana industry in Montana, and that was another vector of that I knew I wanted to write about, because it was going on while I was kind of developing this story. The industry kind of took off in our state. So then, as soon as I started writing about him, though, I saw that he was anything. He just immediately defied all stereotype. And I love that. I think that's a great way to start writing about character, is maybe you start with a stereotypical idea of someone like, a vet from, you know, a veteran of war from Afghanistan, or a pot grower, or a single dad. So he was all of those things. But in what ways is he more than that? In what ways are those ideas, that the preconceived notions that we might have of any of those ideas, in what ways does Sully or any of your character that you're developing complicate those ideas?
Yeah.
And I think that's where it gets interesting.
Oh, I love that idea of starting with stereotype and then asking yourself, how does this not fit? That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wonderful.
Yeah.
So now you say he came to you maybe first, but is that before Eva or?
Yeah.
Wow.
That was before Eva. In fact, at first, Eva was just going to be a minor character. And it was just, I wanted to write about Sully. He just really took over my imagination. And that started from when I was actually in a jazzercise class, believe it or not. This is kind of funny. There are parts of his story of this book that are quite funny, even though it's not really what you'd call a funny book. But I was doing jazzercise in a strip mall type situation, and it had a window out the back. And right next door came a marijuana dispensary.
Uh-huh.
I mean, to the point where months later we were working out and, you know, smelling Reaper. It was just incredible. But while that place was being built and they were first putting it in, there were all these guys that would hang out that back window. And I found it so hilarious that here we are, all these middle-aged women doing their jazzercise, and these guys outside, you know, developing growing their pot and trying to get a business off the ground.
Yeah.
And I loved watching how they dressed and, you know, how they interacted with each other. Usually they're smoking cigarettes. And once again, you know, I was like, okay, stereotype stoners outside smoking, and yet this is completely something new. We haven't seen this before with, you know, business owners, and they're dressed up. A lot of them had fancy cars. They were wearing suits.
Right.
And that fascinated me. So I knew Sully was part of that crowd.
Yeah.
And again, that when I first started writing, the departure from that crowd was where I really got interested.
And then it sounds like the yoga studio turned into Eva's mom's, is it more of an aerobic studio? I'm trying to remember what she teaches.
Yeah, she does. She teaches, that's exactly right. That where I was doing jazzercise,
turned into
a workout studio that teaches various kinds of aerobic classes.
Which is
exactly
great. So is it sort of like a strip mall?
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what it has, a bunch of different businesses in it. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. And okay. Wonderful. Now I'm curious, when you are writing a first draft, do you plan or do you wander?
Oh, I wander.
Yeah.
I make a terrible mess. I am a big, big mess maker. The desk I'm sitting in front of right now is a god awful mess. And, you know, I can't even really tell my kids to clean up their room, because all you have to do is look at my office. I think my desktop sort of reveals what kind of novelist I am. I wander all over the place. And
oh, funny.
I think that's why it takes me a long time, because I wrote about Sully for a solid 6 months before I put him together with Eva, and then realized probably 9 months in that the musician was also part of this story. So,
right.
Yeah, I definitely had to wander to get there.
But that's so interesting, because the musician is where it started for you in a way.
Exactly. I knew I wanted to write about a musician, but I didn't know exactly how.
Oh, that's great. That's great, because I wander too, and I take forever to write, and so I love hearing that. okay. Do you mind if I read something else that I admired, and then we could talk a little bit more about details, which I think you have just beautiful details. Maybe you wander, but when you get there, they're really good. Is that
awesome.
Okay? All right. So this is, I believe this is maybe from Margot's. This is from Margot's point of view. And actually, Margot is the cellist, and she actually does a lot of noticing the outside world. And she, from her, we get a lot of surrounding details. So this is early on again. The fog had reached the canyon. Details emerged from the gray, crowding her. Three crows on the telephone line, jeering. A billowing plastic bag caught on a fence post. The bank of mailboxes at the fork in the road. The one in the middle, open-mouthed. She sat a long time in the driveway, listening to the engine ping and hiss. I love that. That's so great. And, you know, the mailbox with the open-mouthed mailbox is so... I always am asking authors this question, and they always all sort of say, I don't know, but do you take notes all the time about the things that you see in the world, or do you feel like details turn on in your mind as you sit down to write?
Well, thank you for your kind words about that, about my work. I love that.
Yeah.
And the question is, it's a great one. There's so many different ways people have of, you know, kind of keeping track of,
right,
of the poetry and the lyricism in the world. I'd say the latter for me. I don't take a lot of notes, but I will say this. Things don't really, novel writing is frustrating for this very reason. Details and very specific kind of poetic moments, like what you're talking about, will not arise for me unless I have the scene very, very specifically in mind. In other words, there's many, many drafts of that not happening. And in fact, it could just be really frustrating because you can only live with, you know, kind of bad, unspecific prose for so long before you start to go a little crazy. But until the scene is very specifically set in my mind and I kind of know what is supposed to be happening, I know the characters, I know what I want from the scene, then things start to surprise me. Details like the mailboxes and the sounds of the engine, then I can hear those things and notice those things. And I don't know where they come from, but I'm glad they do come.
Yeah.
And then when they do, I kind of have, that's kind of my cue that, okay, we're getting somewhere. This is actually, you know, I might be onto a draft I can keep.
Yeah. Now, do you kind of go out and sit somewhere and look and take notes, or are you able to just imagine the scene while you sit at your...
I imagine it.
Yeah.
I imagine it. I do. I remember with this book, and I feel like this is the most successful I've been at writing descriptions and whatnot. I spent a lot of time, like, just telling myself, no, sit here, you're not done with the scene. Sit here at your desk. I have got a great window right by my desk, and I'm just like, sit here and do not move. Sometimes I would actually take my chair and put it in front of the windows, put my feet up on the sill, and just make myself sit there and be still until I could really, really get into the scene and get very, very specific and feel what the character was feeling.
Yeah. Okay. Great. Now, let's see. The wolf tone is written in multiple points of view. I would call it third person close. And each chapter, we move between Eva and Sully and Margot and others. So is this easier or harder for you to do multiple points of view? And also, did you have anybody who was particularly difficult every time you came to that character and having to represent that character's outlook?
I think point of view is, other than time, figuring out the time frame of the novel, point of view is the hardest thing for me, because everybody's crowding the stage. Everybody wants their voice heard and kind of trying to wrangle that in. And then I remember being so resistant for many years. I wanted it to just be a novel of one point of view, and I just couldn't make that work. I wanted it to kind of be third person omniscient, where I could go in and out of the minds of people of different characters, but mainly it was this narrative voice. That wasn't going to work. And because I didn't feel like I could get close enough to them.
Right.
I feel like then, as far as who was the most difficult, what I would say is that Eva stole the scene every time I wrote about her. So in some ways she was difficult because I couldn't get her to stop talking. You know, the scenes just kept I had to really rein that back in because I just loved her, and she came alive on the page. There was never any reaching for her.
Yeah, it sounds almost like she was one of your
pared down.
Sort of one of your favorites and one of your more difficult challenges.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, I would say that's true.
She's got a great personality, and right from the start, early on. I don't give things away in these interviews, but I will just say that Eva sort of confronts Margot, who's somebody she does not know, and she confronts her with something. And it's like right away we gain all this respect for Eva because she's got chutzpah. She is not afraid of whatever the future might bring. So
that was also some of that, I think, is her youth too. She's only 20, and my very first novel, which was, a long time ago and didn't get published 15 years ago, I wrote about teenagers. But and then I wasn't writing about young people. She was kind of my first young person and definitely my first single mom to write about. So that was fun.
Now, the book that you just mentioned, how do you feel about that book now? All this time has gone by and you've written a lot, I think, probably, this book and also poetry. So how do you feel about that book now? Do you think it's as good as you thought it was when you first tried to get it published?
No. And in fact, I'm glad that it did not get published and it came close. And if it had, I think I would be, it was flawed. And I think I would feel embarrassed of it. It would probably be out of print. And I wasn't ready to write. I didn't realize how complicated it was to write a novel, how involved the writer needed to get. And I think also in that first novel, I didn't really know how to end a story and bring it to its complete circle, so to speak.
Yeah.
So I feel fond recollections for it and, like affection, but happy with its fate.
Right.
It's quiet death.
Have you ever pulled anything out of it to use somewhere else?
I haven't, but I sure learned a lot. That one was set in Wyoming and it was kind of my first big attempt at describing the West. And, that doesn't come easy. It's hard. It's a big place. It's a hard thing to describe a landscape that is so overwhelming and so, it just makes the person feel small. And it can be awfully boring to describe a great big wide open like that. So the more experience I had doing that, I think the better.
Yeah, I'm actually thinking I'm going to jump ahead now and ask a question because what you just said, I actually have pulled out something that you wrote about Montana that I would love to read now. I'm sorry I'm reading all this stuff. I should ask you to read it all, but then we have to find the page numbers and it takes time. And so do you mind if I read a little something?
No, go for it.
Okay, so this is from Sully's point of view, and it's got to do with the nature of Montana, which is not his home. It's not where he's from. So he's from Missouri. So back in Missouri, country boys, and I'm probably saying Missouri wrong. I know you're supposed to say it the way they say it where they're from. Back in Missouri, country boys liked moonshine, banjo, and dancing. The Montana cowboy liked bull riding and steer roping, was used to pain, and lacked any attachments to leisure, a tougher biscuit by far. Without question, the climate was part of it. Knowing nothing but winter, real warmth was unrecognizable to these people. And then I'm going to skip ahead a little bit. For Sully, it was a temperament, some kind of wanderlust that cooled here in the ragged, unpredictable country all along the divide. The flat, long benchlands above the rivers, the ridiculous angles of the breaks, the deeply incised flood banks, miles of empty highway provided an inner settling. Grassy plains undulating in the wind, canyons that dropped open without warning, the lack of symmetry to the place was consoling for a certain kind of person. Grandiosity was part of it. Here, finally, was a backdrop that put you, a man, in the proper scale. You were small, and so was your angst. So I think that's relevant to what you were just saying, and I think you described it very beautifully. So.
Thank you. I definitely do relate to a lot of what Sully feels about Montana. And, for me, Wyoming was where I went first, and Wyoming and Montana both have that massiveness that can kind of put your own self in perspective.
Right. Now, so obviously you feel that way about Montana too. And yeah. I was going to ask you a little bit about writing setting, but also I was going to ask, are you ever likely to describe place in a way that is different from how you yourself see it? If your character perhaps has a different outlook, does that make sense?
I think I will at some point, because I think there's, I think it'd be fun.
Yeah.
Honestly, I think it'd be fun to, for instance, write about a character who came to Montana and, you know, finds it the end of the earth. And you know, feels completely cut off from cultural diversity and, you know, opera and things like that. I think that would be quite fun. And I could understand that, too, frankly.
Yeah. 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 And I guess that's the key, is understanding your characters, even if what you would say first is, you know, this other depiction of Montana. But being able to understand the other perspective is important to being able to write about it.
Yes, I would agree with that. And I feel like it's so, I mean, I often feel like I have, I don't know, an openness about other people too, or I definitely have my opinions, but I also love to hear people talk. And I really don't make a final judgment on others. I don't end up saying, well, I don't like her, or I really don't like him, or I like him. It's more like, yeah, okay. That, you know, staying open and hearing everybody's perspective. I might not agree with it all. I think that's how you have to be with your characters, too, because otherwise, I mean, you don't want to just write about reflections of yourself. It gets kind of boring.
Right, right. Absolutely. Now, you, in your bio, it says that you did attend the Vermont Studio Center, which is near and dear to the hearts of writers that are listening locally. So how did that go? How long were you there? And did was it a... productive period for you?
Oh my gosh. It was just last fall.
Oh.
And it changed everything for me.
Oh,
I mean,
great.
Seriously, I think I got annoying to other people because I was just like, this is so great. I just loved it. I was my first residency ever, frankly. And I was only able, I do have kids, teenagers, and I was only able to get away for 2 weeks. And, but even so I came in the middle. It's usually month rotations there, and a few residents come for 2 weeks, and so everybody already knew each other.
Okay.
So, you know, walking in the dining hall, I thought that was going to be weird. No, nobody was weird at all. Join us. No eye darting. Everyone's meeting my eye, talking to me, asking questions, answering my questions. You know, I met visual artists, poets, and writers. It was just fantastic. Sculptors.
Yeah.
And then once a week, there's the writers and artists share their work. Mm-hmm. And that was just mind-blowing. And I must say this, too. I got more done in 2 weeks than I would have in 2 months. So there really is something to the residency program where you can put all of your life on hold and just focus on your work and your characters and dreaming and thinking and writing. And I remember one of the big shocks for me is that after, you know, there's this communal kitchen. So you go and you eat and then you're done. There's no snacking. There's no wandering about the kitchen. There's no cleanup.
Right.
It's all taken care of. So you can go back to work. That killed me. That I actually had the energy and the time and the desire to go back to work in the evening was just not something I'd experienced since having children years ago.
That's great. They also have a week-long residency for Vermonters in between their normal operation and when they start their new year in the spring. So they like do a week. I think it's like a cleaning week. Maybe they do Vermonters week and then they have a cleaning week and then they start again with their new sessions.
Oh, how wonderful!
But yeah, Vermonters get a week if they are lucky. I want to just pause here and let listeners know that they are listening to WBTV LP Burlington 99.3 FM, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is an interview with the author Christy Stillwell. If you're enjoying the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and help spread the word about Write the Book. Okay, Christy, now this book won the 2017 Elixir Press Fiction Prize, and I did read in your website about your publishing experience. I wonder if you can give us a snapshot of what your publishing experience was like, because it really resonated for me. So,
well, it was like I've alluded to the first novel many years ago, and in fact, this is my third, so it's not, you know, it wasn't like... fresh out of the gate. You know, I had Yippee, Yahoo success. It took a lot of work and a long time. And I also, I've applied with my short fiction for awards over the years. And I just, I came to think of myself as someone who does not win contests. So this was, of course, a thrill and a half to have, to get the message. And it was on, I remember on Labor Day weekend that I had won the fiction award from this small press. And then I will also say, as far as the whole publishing industry, I was really torn about getting an agent. You know, for when I was a young writer, I just thought you had to have an agent, and that if you had an agent, that was going to lead to a contract, and a big contract, a good contract, you know, with publicity money, and you were going to get lots of readers. Well, I had two agents before with each of my other novels, and that did not actually mean publication. It wasn't a slam dunk. And so this time around, when I was querying agents, you know, all over again, and just thinking, you know, I don't know, I just really started to examine my belief system and what I wanted.
Right.
And I kind of determined what I really wanted was a book more than I wanted a big juicy contract at this point in my life. I wanted to have a novel published, and I really believed in this one. More, I felt like it was a way stronger book than the other two, and I was a stronger writer. So I started to look at the small presses, and that became quite exciting. I encourage writers to take a look at small presses and indie presses out there, because they're doing very exciting things. And while it might, you know, maybe you won't get rich, and you might, but I do think you could still find lots of readers, though, if you are willing to do some hustling and getting out there and talking to your bookstores. That whole independent movement and the independent bookstore and independent presses is not dead at all. It's really exciting, lively fiction, and I'm happy to be part of it.
Well, that's great. Now, when you won the prize, did you hear from agents after that? Did anyone reach out to you?
No, I didn't.
Interesting.
That's a good question that no one has asked. No, I still had queries out there, but I was getting a lot of, I guess I didn't realize it's been a long time since I had queried agents, and I didn't realize that silence means no. So a lot of times you're sending out these queries, and you know, you've really kind of worked hard on this letter and, you know, your pitch and even an excerpt from the book, and you just hear nothing.
Right.
Not even from somebody's assistant. That's kind of disheartening. I did get two requests for the manuscript and a couple of partials, so I felt that was a pretty good response in my first wave of, I probably had contacted 30 agents.
Wow.
But
yeah.
No, even after the announcement that I had won the prize, I didn't get any. And I do feel like some writers would go ahead and get an agent saying, I have a contract, could you please be my agent because I need help with the contract. But it was pretty straightforward. And
right.
My publisher and I had a great relationship, so we just went on without one.
Yeah. Okay. All right. Well, okay, I'll ask that later. So I want to actually step back into talking about the Wolf Tone more specifically again. So there are a lot of plot lines that have to do with specific information that I suspect you had to go and research. So one of those is music, as we already said, specifically playing the cello. And then the other one is growing pot and that business, that end of things. And then also veterans and post-war life. So did you do a lot of research on those things?
I did, in particular the pot growing and the music. And I did reference that I met the principal cellist for the local symphony, and she was fantastic, and I kind of shadowed her on and off for a year. Like, she also ended up, she is a teacher of orchestra here at a local school, so I visited her there, and I visited rehearsals and of the symphony rehearsals, and that was largely to get the language. I think any writer who's done research, you know, what you really need is the language. You need to know how people talk about their medium, and so that you can mimic it. That's where the mimicry part of fiction writing comes in, and it's quite fun. But
yeah.
I need to know. I think some writers, I feel like they can get away with more than I can. I kind of need to know a little, you know. I did a lot of research online about music too, and cello playing and string players, and watched movies, read books, and so I had a strong sense of kind of what the musical life might look like. And then for pot growing, I did a ton of our city newspaper did a pretty good series on medical marijuana and kind of this influx, this massive influx of the dispensaries popping up here and there. And there was a whole series in the newspaper. So I read through that entire thing, and it was pretty thorough. And they did a couple of great features. One thing I found interesting about the features, though, on certain grow operations, is they would never give the location in the news stories because there was just so much theft.
Right.
It was really kind of crazy during those initial years when the legislation was iffy and the rules were not yet set and there were a lot of people getting ripped off. So
It can be dangerous, too. Isn't it dangerous? People are looking for where people grow pot, and it's very well protected by, I think, armed people sometimes.
Here, what it ended up being true, and I did not know this at the time I was writing the book, but there's a series of mini storage units way out west of town. And you can drive out there, and you drive up and down the lanes, and you just smell pot, pot. So many, many growers do use the mini storage units. I'd never thought of that before. It's kind of a genius place to do it because it is so discreet. You know, you could set up lighting and ventilation and be just fine and be happy out there. But obviously that wasn't the setting that I chose. I was using that one next door across the wall from where, and that was largely imagined. I thought many, many times I could go in and get a tour, and I purposely didn't want to do it because I really wanted to imagine the place.
Oh, nice.
If I felt like if I went in there and toured the place on which I was basing The New Leaf is what it's called in the novel, it would become more like reportage. And I've been a reporter before. I admire that writing immensely, is for information gathering. But I wanted it to be my description of the New Leaf and just my vision of it. I wanted it to be colored with my own imagination of the place.
Yeah.
And so then I did need actual facts. And as it turned out, my brother was a grower in Oregon, not a commercial grower. He just had a grow in his basement, and he's a very meticulous person. So he knew, he gave me so many details, and I called him so many times. We covered the same ground, like light wattage and yield, plant yield, and different strains of marijuana over and over again. He was always patient with me. He was always willing to go over that material again and again. So that was probably my main source for the pot.
Oh, that's great. Is the book for him? I'm trying to remember at the beginning you mentioned it sounds like somebody who passed away.
Yeah, he did pass away right before the book was published, and I did dedicate it to him. He knew that the book was accepted for the fiction prize, and he knew that it would be published, and he was thrilled to have been part of that and thrilled for me. But he didn't ever actually get to hold it in his hand, and I do regret that deeply.
Yeah, I'm sorry. I wondered about that when I saw that. Let's see. This is a little tiny craft question, but everybody's always talking about show, don't tell. It's become like this old kind of boring thing that, in fact, lots of people will talk against show, don't tell. But I think it's a good way of explaining one kind of craft issue. But I thought you did a really good job in this one moment. This is so tiny, but it really impressed me. So there's a character called Satterfield, who's a friend of Margot's, and he is the director of her strings. What's the name of her? It's not an orchestra that she's playing with.
Oh yeah, she has a small cello group called the Strings, but Satterfield is the maestro of the symphony.
Okay, so he's the maestro. Of the symphony. So
yes.
And they're good friends. And you have this scene where Margot's going to talk to him for some advice, and you introduce him in her point of view before we see him on the page, and you let her explain. You know, you show us in her thought process that he's smug and he has faults. And you tell all of that through Margot's thought process before we meet him. And I thought this was such a good way of skewing us towards liking him because she likes him. And we know that before we ever see him. And so, you know, despite his flaws, we're going to like him. And I thought that was well done. And I imagined that's what you wanted. Do you agree with what I'm saying at all?
Yes, I do. And I think that is a good strategy to use when you're talking about, when you're introducing and you're just dealing with an unlikable character. You can have someone else kind of recognize how unlikable he is and like him anyway.
Right.
And I feel like that's a great strategy because you want, I don't know, the whole issue of likability is such a buzzword right now, you know. Can we write about people who are really foul? And sometimes those people are interesting and we want them in our books and we want to read about what they do. Not evil, but just they do bad things.
Right.
Bad decisions. And so I do think that is a good strategy to keep in your pocket about when introducing a quote-unquote unlikable character. Have somebody else recognize how unlikable he is and like him anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting. It's almost like if you had introduced him to us on the page first, we readers would have formed an opinion. And then if later we found out that Margot really, you know, really cares about him and likes him despite all of this, I don't think it would have had the impact because we'd already have our first impression. Does that make sense?
Yeah, that's a great point. You know, I sound so smart of me. I don't remember thinking, oh, I think I'll introduce him first through Margot, because otherwise he will be not liked at all.
Right.
I think that happened. That was a happy accident that you're pointing out.
Okay.
And I'm going to use it again.
Okay, good.
Thanks.
Let's see. There's another thing. I'm not going to read it because I don't want to take the time. But there was this moment that you used this imagery to represent this incredible moment. And I just wanted to talk about it for 1 second. So Margot is going through a real moment of transition in her life in this book. And there's this moment where she's giving a cello lesson to a student named Pip. And as he's playing this beautiful music for her, she walks out of the room and goes out onto her deck. And she stands on the deck looking at the view and thinking about her life and thinking about what her life has been until now and also thinking about some of the things that have been going on. I won't go into detail, but then Pip stops playing and he comes to the door and she turns around. And so there's Pip in the doorway and there's a glass sliding door on either side of him and some glass above him. And all of the scenery that she's just been looking at is reflected in that glass. And I thought that was such a stunning moment because she is looking at that moment at both what has been and what can be or what the possibilities. I don't know. It was like this beautiful way of using imagery to represent what you had just been talking about. Do you remember writing that?
Thank you. Yeah, I do remember writing that. And I remember that being one of those moments that came about, like I was talking about earlier, that lyricism doesn't happen for me until the scene is completely set and I know the people so well. And so that was late in the writing of the book that scene occurred. And I thought that scene was also necessary because it is a moment where Margot is arrested by her own inner life. It's mm-hmm. kind of, you know, knocking on her head saying, here I am. And she's realizing how much she misses her son and how much who's away at college and how much of what's going on for her might have to do with loss and grief just over the fact that her boy's growing up.
Yeah. Let's see. I want to ask if you've read any books lately that you might recommend to listeners who are readers.
I have. I've gotten very excited about, this is not actually a new book, but it's an Irish book. And I remember when I was in college reading a lot of Irish literature and just being amazed at how relentless they are on the emotional side. They do not turn away from grief and big emotions and difficult things, and yet it is bearable. And this one is My Dream of You by Nuala O'Fuaillean. I think it's how you pronounce her last name.
Okay.
And it's from, I think, 02 or 03. She had that memoir that was out, I think, in the late 90s called Am I Somebody? And I remember I was working in bookstores at the time, so I remember selling a lot of that. But the novel, My Dream of You, I didn't really, that was never on my radar, and I just happened upon it, and it just knocked my socks off. It's kind of like a much earlier version of the Ilana Ferrante, because it's a woman narrator.
Okay.
And it's so deep in her psyche and her life.
Oh, great.
I really loved that one.
Yeah, that's not on my radar at all, so I'm glad to hear a new one. Thank you.
Oh, really good. And then I had another one called At the Gate of All Wonder by Kevin McElvoy, and that is a new book, and it's a small press. It's one of these small press books that I get really excited about. That one's from Tupelo Press.
Okay.
And it's just so different. It's so not mainstream. And it's a man, Kevin McElvoy, is writing from the viewpoint of a woman, and he does so beautifully. And it, for me, was this novel in kind of the narrator, who's this woman, Sam, is trying so hard to obscure the facts of what's gone on in her life, what's going on now. The setting is that she takes in the woods of Western North Carolina. She takes young girls and teaches them to be lost. She takes them to get lost, and parents sign up for this. They sign up their kids to go learn how to be lost with Sam, and she teaches them how to listen. And one of the refrains of the book is, "Have you heard?" She keeps teaching that. They say that to one another all the time because they're listening to nature. They're listening to the earth.
Oh,
listening
wow.
to everything. And so it's so obscure, you don't really know what's going on, and yet you piece together what is going on through these sounds and language. It's fascinating.
Yeah. Okay, wonderful. Thank you.
Okay,
so just a couple more questions, and I know we have to wrap up soon. There comes a point in the narrative of The Wolf Tone where Margot has a sexual experience that I found extremely affecting. And I don't want to ruin anything but by saying what happens or even with whom, but and keeping in mind that this is radio, I do want to ask you if you have any advice for writers who are working on sex scenes. I think it can be very hard to write sex well, whether or not it's good sex or not good sex, whatever, just writing that intimacy well. And I wonder if you have any advice for writers who are working on that.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with you. I think it's difficult. It's a huge question, too. I mean, it's so hard to... I remember once talking about a sex scene that I had written in workshop, and the whole thing devolved into like this giggling, joke-making session. So it's really hard to learn about it, too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's hard to talk about how to write sex scenes in workshop because everybody gets so embarrassed. But
funny.
I think the first thing that you decide as a writer is it going to happen between these two characters? Right, like you've got to decide.
Right,
are two characters going to, or are they not? So once you get that decided, then your next question is, well, how are you going to tell it? You can try to, you know, the amount of detail you go into,
right.
And is it going to be in the, you know, present in a full-on scene, or is it going to be remembered, kind of in flashes, which is what I went with. But I do think that the sex scene should be. If you're going to go into detail, it should be earned. And I guess in the way in The Wolf Tone, it's about many things. And one of those things that the novel is about is parents and parenthood. And I feel like a book about parenting and parents, especially teen parents, is going to be also about sex. I mean,
right.
So in that regard, the theme was there. And so I felt pretty good. And then the next thing I had to decide was the level of detail, because I think one of the dangers of writing about sex is that you're going to go into gratuitous detail just to get attention, just to grab attention, because it's going to grab attention, right?
Yeah.
I mean, there's no question about that. I feel like in that scene that you're talking about late in the book, that's a big deal. I felt like it was pretty important, and because it gets pretty graphic.
It does.
And it is shocking and surprising, and I've heard that from a lot of readers, and it's somewhat violent even.
Right.
And I felt like the amount of detail, because she could have just remembered it in a general sense. She could have remembered it. I could have kept silent about it, you know, because sometimes less is more. You
right.
hear that a lot when
yeah.
teachers are talking about writing about sex. But in this particular case, I felt like if readers were left to imagine what happens to Margot in that scene, they would imagine something pretty tame and pretty sober and possibly
right.
mellow, or because of the type of character she is. And I needed the details to indicate just what kind of line she has crossed that moment.
It kind of circles back to what you said about stereotype. You know, I mean, if you don't name it, then your readers might stereotype the kind of sex that Margot would have. And that's not what you intended for that scene. It's not what you intended for her experience there.
Right. Yeah. And it was meant to be transformative and also kind of a new low in a way.
Right.
And yet that's not all it is. It's more complicated than that. And yeah, so I think I messed around with that scene so much, and I just thought, no, I can't write that. You know, then you start thinking about your relatives reading it. And, oh my God. And in the end, I couldn't not do it. I took it out. I put it back in. I toned it down. And finally, you know, I had to go with my gut. And again, I do take a long time, but I finally hit on a way that I could write it with the level of detail I felt like it needed. And I just have to live with the fallout. So I love hearing that you think it was justified.
I do. And I think it's true that it's a bit shocking, but when I said it was very affecting, I mean, I thought that it really moved me, you know, and so I guess because we can't really go into detail about what happens, I'll just say that I thought it was very well done. And I'm glad you were willing to talk about writing sex scenes. Before we finish up, I wonder if you might have a writing prompt to offer to listeners who are writers.
Oh yeah, I'll talk about something that I did recently that worked for me, and it was this. I was reading. It came from reading something really poetic. It was actually in Michael Ondaatje's book Warlight, which so much of that novel has these really vivid scenes. And in particular, there was a scene of it's told by a young man remembering his teenage years. And one of the incidents that he, or an experience that he repeats often, is being on this barge on the river in London. And so I started thinking about what scenes do you have, or what do you know that you could write about? I mean, probably Ondaatje did research on, you know, river barges. But
right.
Is there anything that you know even a little bit about that you could turn into a haunting, recurring scene like that you could follow through with? Maybe you'd have to do some research. You know, maybe you don't know it real well. But like for me, I started thinking about hay, baling of hay, the cutting of hay, the growing of hay.
Yeah.
I don't have any property. I don't grow hay, but it's always fascinated me. It's my favorite. It's one of my favorite times of the year to watch the swathers out cutting the hay, especially when the onions, when they get two cuttings from their acreage. I just started thinking, could I write a scene about cutting hay? Could I write about the swather machinery? What details do you know a little bit about that you could research to know more and create a whole mood and a whole scene? It could be, you know, cutting trees, trimming hedges. It doesn't have to be a huge thing. Mowing the lawn.
Right.
Could count,
Yeah.
So like, what can you know that you could just sit and write a page or two about, that you could file away and use for some character somewhere in a longer work or a story, that could become kind of this lyrical moment?
Yeah. Okay. That's great. And it's funny. I love the hay example, because we have a lot of that happening around here too. And it is very, it's a very unique visual that you see when they're doing that. Well, listen, thank you so much for speaking with me, Christy. I want to mention again, the name of the book is The Wolf Tone by Christy Stillwell, and it's published by Elixir Press. Before you go, can you share your website where listeners can learn more if they would like?
I sure can. Thank you so much for having me. What a great conversation.
Oh, great.
And my website is Christy Stillwell, which is ChristyStillwell.com.
All right. Awesome. I'm going to say goodbye now, and we'll be in touch. And thank you so much for your beautiful book.
Thank you.
That again was a conversation with Christy Stillwell. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know that archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates. You can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. If you have a guest to suggest or comments about the show or news about book-related events, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If you like the show, please rate it in iTunes, like it on Facebook, and tell all your friends. From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, you're listening to 99.3 FM, WBTV-LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers, and I am Shayla Connor Shapiro. Have a great week.